To begin, though, I'll simply say that my message in the age of American unreason is this. As a nation, we're really in serious intellectual trouble. Enmeshed in what I think of as a crisis of memory and attack on rationality that could never have been envisaged by the believers in progress who founded this nation, or for that matter, by most of the people who created the hardware and software that make the internet possible. Our current era of unreason is at odds not only with America's Enlightenment heritage, but with modern scientific knowledge. And this toxic mixture of anti-intellectualism, anti-rationalism, and sheer ignorance is affecting our culture as a whole, not only our political culture. In 1837, in a speech known as the American Scholar Oration, which really became famous around the nation as soon as it was delivered, Ralph Waldo Emerson observed that the mind of this country, taught to aim at low objects, eats upon itself. Emerson was issuing a challenge to a young nation engaged in building up its intellectual capital. But I think his words resonate even more strongly today in a society that I believe has been engaged in dissipating its intellectual capital for several decades, even as we've created technological marvels that could not have been envisaged in the 19th century or even 50 years ago. I think that all of our current problems, from our involvement in a war based on disregard for evidence to a healthcare crisis that is the product of fears stirred up by characters on television commercials, that many of these things can be traced to the intellectual failings of a society that has for too long aimed its mind at low objects. Now, if I were a politician, I'd probably be calling you folks right about now. But that's one word you're not going to hear from me tonight. I'd be happy to call you citizens or ladies and gentlemen or even just human beings, but not folks, that term so beloved by every political candidate trying to prove that he or she is just one of the boys or just one of the girls. This word is a real plague, spread by the President of the United States, pompous television anchors, radio talk show hosts, and everybody attempting to demonstrate his or her identification with wholesome American values. Now, the popularity of appeals to folks, a rural colloquialism that was once considered fine, it's fine for the playground, but not for the schoolroom, for the corner bar, but not for a presidential speech, embodies so much about the dumbing down of our culture over the past four decades. If you looked up any important presidential speech in the history of the United States before 1980, you wouldn't find a single patronizing appeal to folks, even though it was used in ordinary conversation all the time. Just imagine, we hear highly resolved that these folks shall not have died in vain, that this government of the folks, by the folks, and for the folks. In the 1950s, even though there were no orators of Lincoln's eloquence on the political scene, voters still expected their leaders to employ dignified, if not necessarily erudite, speech. Adlai Stevenson may have sounded too much like an intellectual for the taste of average Americans, but proper grammar and respectful forms of address were mandatory for anyone seeking high office. Dwight Eisenhower was much mocked by intellectuals at the time, was a Demosthenes compared with what we're used to today. The gold standard of presidential oratory for adults in the 50s was, of course, the memory of Franklin Roosevelt, whose patrician accent in no way detracted from his extraordinary ability to make a direct connection with ordinary people. It's really impossible to read the transcripts of FDR's famous fireside chats and not mourn the passing of a civic culture that appealed to Americans to expand their knowledge and understanding instead of pandering to the lowest common denominator. Roosevelt would no more have addressed his fellow citizens as folks than he would have uttered an obscenity over the radio. At the end of 1940, attempting to prepare his countrymen for the coming of war and to tell them that America must become the arsenal of democracy, the president spoke in the characteristic terms to the public, and I'd just like to read you a brief excerpt. "Tonight, in the presence of a world crisis, my mind goes back 8 years to a night in the midst of a domestic crisis. I well remember that while I sat in my study in the White House preparing to talk to the people of the United States, I had before my eyes the picture of all those Americans with whom I was talking. I saw the workmen in the mills, the mines and the factories, the small shopkeeper, the farmer doing his spring plowing, the widows and old old men wondering about their life savings. Now, these words, their dignity, their respect for the public, make me want to weep, really, even though I'm reading them and not hearing them. They ought to make us all want to weep. Substitute folks for people, farmers, old men, and widows, and the relationship between the abandonment of dignified public speech and the degradation of the political process becomes clear. To call for resolution and a spirit of patriotism and sacrifice is to call upon people to rise above their everyday selves and behave as citizens. To keep telling Americans they're just folks is to expect nothing special. A ratification, exaltation of the ordinary, that's one of the distinguishing marks of anti-intellectualism in any era. Now, we're not hearing much about America's intellectual problems in this campaign for the obvious reason that candidates are hotly competing to pretend that they're just like everybody else. An answering dumbed-down media representative who asks questions about flag lapel pins instead of the war in Iraq or the state of the economy. To be too well-informed, too well-educated, is to risk that most damning of charges, elitism. In the Democratic primary race, we've witnessed the ridiculous spectacle of a Yale Law School graduate and a Harvard Law School graduate and a former editor of the Harvard Law Review arguing about which one of them is more of an elitist. I began writing The Age of American Unreason with the idea of doing what would, in some respects, be a sequel to Richard Hofstadter's classic work, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, which was published in early 1963 on that hopeful cusp between the McCarthy era and the social convulsions of the late 60s. This period now seems as distant to me as the Peloponnesian Wars. Hofstadter was concerned mainly with endemic anti-intellectual tendencies that have been a part of the American cultural landscape since the dawn of the Republic. And he saw some of these tendencies as the flip side of America's better impulses as well. For example, the democratization of education, which America was very eager to do early on. No country has made more of a point of education than America, but also no country has been more suspicious of too much education. But the main thing is that Hofstadter was writing at the very dawn of the video culture. And I don't think that he could have foreseen what has happened during the past four decades because nobody saw it becoming this all-encompassing. I think today's anti-rationalism feeds on and is fed by an ignorant popular culture of video images and unremitting noise. Indeed, one of the most disturbing aspects of American culture today, to me, is that anti-rationalism and anti-intellectualism have become united. I can't call myself a cultural conservative, obviously, because that term has been hijacked by the religious right and propagated by the media, and it's customarily used to describe a person preoccupied with such matters as the preservation of the phrase under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, the promotion of premarital chastity, and the protection of cancer patients from marijuana addiction. And in that regard, I have to add that I was watching the evening news just before I came here tonight, the local news, as I always do when I'm in another city. And one of the big stories, apart from Safeco in Seattle today, is something called Operation Green Reaper, in which DEA enforcement agents are blanketing the Seattle suburbs, where apparently, a lot of people are growing marijuana in their homes. The TV news showed bales of wire and reflectors and things. Don't ask me how these things enable people to grow marijuana indoors. But this was the big local story today, the government's big victory, which at a time when we have no other problems, you can imagine. I've gotten off my track, but Green Reaper, really, I couldn't resist talking about it because it's such an example of an issue that is kind of a cultural conservative issue and why I can't call myself a cultural conservative. I mean, you might say a real conservative would want to conserve those marijuana plants. I don't know. It is hard to talk about this without being seen as a Chicken Little running around saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. But what if the sky really is falling? One difference between the environment in which Hofstadter was writing and today's political and cultural environment is well illustrated by two presidential visits to France, one by John Kennedy in 1961 and the other by George Bush in 2002. Kennedy, as those of you who are old enough to will to know will recall, wowed both the French and the Americans at home by displaying and using as his interpreter with Charles de Gaulle, a wife who spoke fluent French. Now, Kennedy himself didn't speak French at all, basically. But he saw this as a deficiency, not something to be proud of, which is why he enlisted his wife's services. Bush, by contrast, seems to think that there's something sinister about any American speaking French. At a joint press conference with then-President Jacques Chirac in Paris, Bush responded petulantly when NBC's correspondent David Gregory posed a question to Chirac in fluent French. Bush, I happened to be watching that news conference. Bush's face got red, puffed up, and he said, "Very good," he snapped. "The guy memorizes four words, and he plays like he's intercontinental." That's a direct quote. No, I'm not making a mistake. That is what he actually said. An amazed Gregory started to say something in reply, but Bush cut him off and said, "I'm impressed. Que bueno. I'm literate in two languages." Well, the implication that any American who dresses a foreign leader in his own language must be putting on an act was very clear. But I don't think that George Bush, and I've been asked this, talk show hosts have asked me this, don't you think that the Bush administration is responsible for dumbing down America? No, I don't. I think that Bush's election is a symptom of where we are as a culture. I don't think Bush is responsible for dumbing down America. In fact, I think he's too dumb to dumb down America. Sorry. And I should emphasize also that anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism are phenomena that encompass both the extreme cultural right and the extreme cultural left. We've seen plenty of it from the cultural left over the past 40 years, too. I'll go into a little bit more of that a little bit later. So, three main characteristics distinguish the current wave of anti-intellectualism from the more endemic forms described by Hofstadter. Number one, as I've mentioned, is the triumph of the video culture. And we are becoming an increasingly illiterate culture, even as we are more literate in the technical sense. A really startling report issued in December by the National Endowment for the Arts found that only half of Americans under 44 read a single book last year. By that, I don't mean that Americans aren't reading Tolstoy and Henry James. I mean they didn't read a single detective novel, a single self-help book, a single bodice-ripper romance. They didn't read my book. They didn't, as I told Stephen Colbert last night, read his book either. He said he didn't care as long as they bought it. But I mean the character Stephen Colbert said that. And I can actually relate to that, except the people who don't read books also tend not to buy them. That's the second anti-intellectual force today is the quixotic persistence of religious fundamentalism. And I make no bones about it. Fundamentalism, not religion, but fundamentalist religion, which depends on the belief that every word in the Bible is literally true, is fundamentally anti-rational. Now, of course, fundamentalism, although it wasn't called that until the 20th century, has also been a part of the American scene since the very beginning. Today, I think what's different is the dissonance between fundamentalism and the state of modern knowledge. The United States is the only country in the developed world in which a large proportion of the population, about 30%, still believes in the literal truth of sacred books. The final element shaping the American intellectual scene today is a really troubled public education system. All of these forces have fused anti-intellectualism with anti-rationalism and what I call junk thought, which again emanates from both the left and the right. The chief characteristic of junk thought is imperviousness to evidence, although it's often couched in scientific-sounding language, really rather like intelligent design, which in fact appropriates the language of science to promote a basically anti-scientific theory. I'll give you a good example of junk thought, a few of them later, and throw open for your questions. But first, I'd like to make a connection between that and the forces that are dumbing down our culture at every level. Let's begin with the media. This is hardly an original observation, but for the first time in human history, we can be connected to our video and sound equipment 24 hours of the day, and many people are. Now, obviously, the infotainment culture has no borders. One of the things I think that has made Americans particularly susceptible to it, though, is that our national love affair with technology, which has its good side, and because it's created many marvels of which the microchip is only the latest, but this love affair with technology as unremittingly good also leads us to seek technological solutions for what are essentially non-technological problems. Now, of course, aggrieved eulogies for print culture and railing against the domination of American culture by infotainment have become so common that almost no one except people who make a living from the printed word pay attention to critiques that could easily be titled The Decline and Fall of Everything. I know this. It's now become more insulting to call someone a Luddite than to call her a cheat, a druggie, or a slut. And finally, there's the obligatory statement before saying anything adverse about the impact of the video media on young children. You have to say that every generation, of course, has always taken a dim view of the intellectual attainments of, quote, young folks, unquote. During the past few years, there's been a particularly ominous push, really since I've been writing this book, I wasn't even able to get it all in because the news all came late, to convince adults that children ought to be introduced to video almost from the cradle, as long as it's educational video, of course. One of the most common statements made on blogs by anxious parents, fearful that too much viewing is bad for their children, is, "We never let our child watch TV. Only videos." Now, home box office's classical Baby, which premiered in the spring of 2005, is a perfect illustration of the genre. This half-hour film consists of musical excerpts from Tchaikovsky, Bach, Duke Ellington, and Irving Berlin, all accompanied by animated images of clowns, fairies, and animals, and really irritating glimpses of famous paintings by Jackson Pollock, Vincent van Gogh, and Monet. They're irritating because these paintings, when you just flash them for a half second, are really ugly, actually. When groups opposed to marketing television programs to infants objected, one Dr. Eugene Berenson, a child psychiatrist on the staff of Harvard Medical School and, what else, a consultant to HBO's classical Baby, declared that to say this kind of TV is tantamount to saying that is bad is tantamount to saying that art is bad. Now, please don't think, I know, I'm not one of those people who wants to bring back a non-existent golden age in which people never watch TV or videos or various versions of these videos on the web. It's a fine thing for parents to get after a day of work to gain an hour for themselves by putting a three-year-old in front of a video for an hour so that they can have an adult conversation. My problem is when that hour turns into 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours. Right here at the University of Washington, researchers have found that children who are exposed to video under the age of two, in fact, have smaller vocabularies and shorter attention spans than those who were exposed later on after age three or four. And now let's turn to the subject of computers and the web. If any of you have read any reviews of my book, you know that a number of them have called me a Luddite and suggested that I've ignored the explosion of reading and writing on the Internet. The mantra goes, computers are making us smarter. No, they're not. That's exactly the same thing as someone during the Renaissance saying, forks are making us better eaters. When all forks did was enable us to eat without getting grease all over our hands and faces. My point is that computers and the web are tools. They're among the most useful tools the human race has ever invented, although the fork is pretty useful too. But their relationship to information is similar to the relationship between eating utensils and food. And I would argue that when we read on the web, what we're doing is not reading in the traditional sense, but searching for bits of information, rather like birds or prey. That capacity is wonderful, but the ability to acquire information more easily shouldn't be confused with knowledge, critical thinking, or for that matter, an appreciation of beauty if you're talking about images. I'll give you an example. When I was writing my last book, Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, I had read a number of biographies of Walt Whitman that mentioned the scathing reviews that greeted the first edition of Leaves of Grass in 1852. These books would give brief quotations, and I wanted to see the original reviews. Now, only 10 years ago, this would have meant crawling painfully through 19th century magazines on microfilm, one of the things as a writer I've most hated to do all these years. So I thought, well, I'll give it a shot on the web. And there, on an academic website devoted to Whitman, I found the text of one 1850s and 1860s review after another. But what I'm talking about here is essentially a shortcut, a wonderful shortcut, but it's useless unless you know what you're looking for in the first place. The web is really only as good as the knowledge and the research skills of the person using it, and people who don't know much themselves aren't going to get much out of the web. Garbage in, garbage out. If people spend their time on the web watching girls beating each other on YouTube or chugging 21 shots straight down on their 21st birthday or trashing their strange spouses, which is the newest sport, the web can become just another part of the dumbing down of America. In last Sunday's edition of the New York Times, there was a revealing piece by an editor of collegehumor.com, and the headline was, "I Waste People's Time Online." Actually, the time he wants to waste, as he explained, is mainly that of 18 to 24-year-old men, because, quote, traditional male comedy, the Stoogish variety, is what gets young men on the web. What guides his selection, this author said, is that the video be, quote, short, easily understood, and universal, not long, demanding, and based in evidence and reality. Sounds rather like our political campaigns. Another piece of the anti-rational puzzle is our educational system. We're becoming an increasingly innumerate as well as illiterate culture. In international surveys, American 15-year-olds ranked 24th out of 29 countries in mathematical literacy. In science, we're not at the bottom. We're mediocre, 14th out of 28. Now, this isn't to suggest that America is unique in this, but there is a unique gap between America's image of itself as the world's leader in science and technology and the reality of a nation that, in fact, performs very poorly in relation to a lot of other developed countries. But the issue isn't just that American students perform poorly on standardized tests in relation to other countries, but simply that large numbers of adults don't possess the requisite knowledge for intelligent discussions of public affairs, which requires a basic grasp of the laws of probability, math again, as well as the realities of history. It's often noted as unique that two-thirds of Americans say they don't believe in any form of evolution, even that guided by God. And this is often attributed solely to religious fundamentalism. But consider this. According to surveys conducted for the National Science Foundation over the last 20 years, two-thirds of Americans are unable to identify DNA as the key to heredity. 9 out of 10 don't understand what radiation is. And 1/5 still believe that the sun revolves around the earth. Now, such responses have nothing to do with religion, but they do certainly point to a stunning failure of public education at the elementary and secondary level, because there's no reason that you should have to be an intellectual or a college graduate to know that the sun doesn't revolve around the earth, and the DNA is what makes each of us a unique human being. So this level of ignorance provides fertile ground for political appeals based on sheer ignorance, which is what I call junk thought. Junk thought is a centrist phenomenon. That's what's so frightening about it. In a stunning example of the mainstreaming of junk thought coupled with junk science, Supreme Court Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy, in a 5-4 opinion that upheld a ban on so-called partial birth abortion last year, cited the, quote, severe depression and loss of self-esteem that may follow an abortion as one rationale for the court's decision. The only problem with this is there's no evidence at all to support the idea that depression is any more common in women who've had abortion than in those who've had 10 children. In fact, I'd like to see a study of depression in women who've had 10 children. Kennedy even admitted that, quote, he admitted this in his opinion, "We find no reliable data to measure this phenomenon," but said, nevertheless, it seems unexceptionable to conclude that some women come to regret their choice to abort the infant they have created. In fact, Kennedy was alluding to a junk science concept, post-abortion syndrome, invented by anti-choice organizations and based entirely on anecdotal accounts. Yet the court majority chose to ignore real scientific studies and instead rely on anecdotal findings that are the essence of junk science. Of course, some women regret their choice of having had an abortion. Some women also suffer from severe postpartum depression and suicidal depression. But we don't, therefore, pass laws preventing all women or even those with a history of postpartum depression from bearing children. My point is that junk thought is not just silly, but it's dangerous. Anti-rationalism is dangerous, and both are really deadly to democracy. We're not hearing enough about the responsibility of Americans themselves, not the demon entity known as Washington, for the low level of our public discourse. The punditocracy likes to talk about the political culture as if it were separate from the culture as a whole, but I don't believe that. It's so much easier, so much safer politically for candidates to say you were the victims of a lie than to suggest that voters and their elected representatives in both parties must shoulder much of the blame for their willingness to be deceived about such matters as so-called evidence for the necessity of the war in Iraq. Now, I think there's a direct connection between a popular culture in which half of the electorate under 45 doesn't read books or newspapers and a political culture in which candidates deliberately drop their G's at the end of patronizing speeches to the folks. What a ludicrous spectacle it is to watch candidates presenting their bowling credentials to the American public or downing shots of whiskey with beer chasers to show that they're not white wine elitists. Now that's style, but here's the substance. When Clinton and Obama were asked by Nobel Prize winning scientists to hold a debate about science and education, solely about it, neither of them would agree to do it, apparently because they could both hear America's television remotes clicking them off. So instead of debating about science and education, they got together at an institute of higher learning called Messiah College to go over the whole family values business yet again and to discuss which of them could lay claim to a deeper level of faithiness, which I've sort of adapted from Colbert's truthiness. I think it's good. So what's to be done? And I really hate it when people ask me that, and you're going to say that my answer is a cop-out, and it is. I don't know whether these trends are irreversible, but I do know this. To begin to do anything about this crisis of memory and knowledge, we first of all have to be conscious of it. We have to look at how we spend our time and how we encourage our children to spend their time. I've had all sorts of people come up to me after lectures and say they, quote, don't have time to read books, even though they'd like to. Well, but the average American manages to squeeze out a lot of time for video and television and video games. The average 18 to 24-year-old spends 3 hours a day on the web alone. We do have time, even the busiest of us, and how we choose to spend it is the question. Like all conservationists, a cultural conservationist in today's America can only act in hope while living with amply justified fear. In his American Scholar oration, Emerson asked, "What is the remedy? Is it not the chief disgrace in the world not to be a unit, not to be reckoned one character, not to yield that peculiar and particular fruit which each man was created to bear, but to be reckoned in the hundred, in the thousand, in the gross? Not so, brothers and friends. Please let it not be so with us." Thank you. I think that there is a relationship between incivility and a general dumbing down, and I'll tell you why. A great example, I cite it in my book, but Russell Baker actually came up with it in a piece on the decline of conversation, which I really think that video is to reading as real conversation is to a lot of what we do in email, which is basically short, snappy. I'm not saying that everybody's emails are like that, but mostly email is an informational exchange. It's not really a discursive sharing of thoughts and feelings. So I think the decline of conversation is very closely related to the decline of civility, and it was Baker who pointed out in a piece on conversation, the New York Review of Books, He reminded us of Dick Cheney telling Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont on the Senate floor, go fuck yourself. This is an amazing thing for the Vice President of the United States to say to a United States Senator because they disagree about something involving military appropriations. And Baker then went on to cite some great examples of the kind of insults that 19th century people threw around. One that Speaker Reed at the end of the 19th century said of a political opponent, with a few more brains, he'd be a half-wit. Isn't that great? There's nobody in public life today, you know, who is capable of such a witty. I mean, it's a lot funnier, isn't it, than what Dick Cheney said? So I think in that respect, there is a relationship between incivility and dumbing down in that the less imagination we have, the more we resort to these kind of formulaic insults, which really, I mean, that in fact, that word that Dick Cheney used has been deprived of all force because it's used so often. There was a time when maybe that would have been a great insult for a great crime, but it has no meaning at all anymore.
I guess I'm required to say that a lot of people that I talk about or debate with on the internet that I really appreciate because I feel like I've gotten a lot better and learned a lot more about some of the things that I'm interested in because I have an opportunity to participate in some forums and some discussion groups that challenge me in ways that would never have happened in my neighborhood. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying. At the same time, it's not all just clicking on pictures of girls. I wonder if one of the big problems that we have is that we've really lost faith in the whole rational enterprise to save us. And what we're looking for is a story that makes sense of our life, that gives us a direction to go, that gives us a reason to make a choice. And what we're really doing is floundering. You can call us dumb, but I mean, a lot of people, I think, just don't care because they think, and one of the reasons we turn to fundamentalism is because maybe it's not a very believable story, but it's a story.
Well, you could say that about almost anything. Maybe it's not a very believable story, but it's a story. That's an explanation. But, you know, first of all, that's a serious question. Your first comment about the internet, it really depends on what kinds of blogs you go to, what you engage in. I have to say that my doubts about, there are great things on the internet. However, you say that you've learned a lot from people who have different views from yours. My experience of the internet is that people tend to go to what they already agree with. I think that your experience is more the minority goal on the internet, and it's a great one. But I think in an odd way that a lot of the million cable channels and the blogs on the internet enable a lot of people just to seek validation of the opinions they already hold. Look, most of the time when I lecture, and I'm not surprised in Seattle because the composition of this city, it's a very educated, thinking, not everybody, of course, but you know what I mean. Most of the time when I go to lecture, 95% of the people in the room already agree with me. Conservatives tell me, serious conservatives, I'm not talking about people like Ann Coulter, but I'm talking about, I'm talking about serious conservatives who aren't morons out there in outer space. Report the same thing, that 95% of the people in their audiences already agree with them. This was not always the case in American society. In the 19th century, for example, when Thomas Henry Huxley, who is the great British naturalist and the popularizer of Darwin's theory of evolution, came here, I mean, thousands and thousands of people in every city went to hear him. Even though, surely, in a country more religious than it was today, many of them must have been truly shocked by his views on the and they were. The letters to the editor from the papers of those days show it. And yet, they sort of were part of an American tradition. And I think, by the way, that is an Enlightenment tradition, too, in Iran, of sort of wanting to see for yourself whether the devil really has horns. Now, about people looking for a story or a narrative to make sense of their lives, well, I don't see that there's anything new about that at all. I mean, religion of various kinds has always been a narrative to make sense of one's life. And that was very understandable at a time when we knew very little. And I should amend that. I'm talking strictly about fundamentalists. I don't agree with my friend Sam Harris that moderate religion is worse than fundamentalism because it's a stalking horse for him. I'm an atheist, but I don't agree with that. I kind of think if the world were full of liberal Catholics and Unitarians and Reformed Jews and so on, we wouldn't have some of the problems in public life that we have today. But the thing is, the question is, I think for our country, is why is fundamentalism so much more powerful here than it is in other developed countries in the world? And there are a lot of reasons for that, but I do think that fundamentalism, unlike moderate religion, is fundamentally anti-rational. And the fact is, it's not considered polite to say so, but I'm not running for the presidency. But the fact is fundamentalism is strongest among people with only a grade school or a partial high school education, which is not to say that there aren't all kinds of educated people who believe it too, but it's strongest in the least educated sections of the country and among people who have the least education. Yes.
On the interview with Bill Moyer that you did, you rattled off some just appalling statistics about the number of people who, you know, still believe in all kinds of weird things. Do you remember those? Maybe they're in your book.
They're all in my book. But basically, at least half of Americans, more than half of Americans, believe in miracles and angels and ghosts. But also, just in general, Americans have more supernatural beliefs, except for astrology, which is something that a lot of people believe in around the world. However, astrology has not been used to shape public policy in the countries where people believe in it, which wasn't the case 500 years ago. You can consider astrology a harmless hobby, but certainly fundamentalism has influenced our political process in a way that anti-rational beliefs haven't. But there's another statistic that I don't think that I mentioned on Bill Moyer's, which also shows 2/3 of Americans say they don't believe in any form of evolution, even that guided by God. And then that's consistent. And it seems shocking. So the question is, if it's all religious, since only 1/3 of Americans are fundamentalists, what accounts for the other 1/3? Well, I have a theory. Because there are also Gallup polls that show in this supposedly the most religious country on earth, half of Americans can't name the four Gospels, and half of Americans can't name Genesis as the first book of the Bible. Now, my theory about why so many Americans say they want both creationism and evolution taught in public schools is probably these people who don't know that Genesis is the first book of the Bible are probably not very clear on what creationism is either. So, okay, let both creationism and evolution be taught in public schools. What may be the truth is that we're not very clear on either of them. And certainly those statistics about lack of knowledge of the Bible, they really do point to a decline of what was once considered our common culture. Because 100 years ago, people who were serious agnostics all knew the Bible backwards and forwards, just as extremely religious people did. I think that's a very telling thing that shows that ignorance, you know, isn't just at one end of the spectrum; it goes right across. Yes.
Do you think that this drift towards, or this dumbing down and drift towards atheism, just sort of happened, or do you think it had a push?
A little push from whom?
That's what I'm asking.
Oh, that's what you're asking me. Well, I think it's as the sociologists say that it's overdetermined. I really do regard the media as one of the major factors. But if what you're asking is, and maybe this isn't what you're asking.
Is somebody doing this to us on purpose?
Well, nobody has to do it to us on purpose, really, do they? Because we've been doing it to ourselves. You know, the thing about the infotainment culture is this. It's very seductive. It comes little by little. I have been asked by a lot of left-wing talk show hosts, in addition to those who ask me, is Bush responsible? Aren't the corporations responsible for feeding us all of this stuff? Well, I mean, I think the answer is yes and no. It's a very circular thing. I mean, the fact is, if you look at the array of things on the web, if you look at all the cable channels, we could be watching the equivalent of public TV all the time. time, but we don't want to. It's not, are the corporations forcing us to watch The Biggest Loser? No, they're not. But I get into a lot of arguments with people about this, because a lot of people, and I think this is part of the problem with our culture, is we've become a lazy culture. In that it's a lot easier to do some things than others. It is a lot easier at the end of the day when you come home tired just to put a kid in front of the TV set than to spend time reading to them and talking to them, a little kid. It really is. And it's not just, I was one of those people who always told myself, I don't watch very much TV. Because I was always had a book in my hand at the same time. And a couple of years ago, I participated in National TV Turnoff Week, which actually is going on again this week. But I can't do that because I'm traveling. I have to watch the news in my hotel room. But anyway, I participated in National TV Turnoff Week. And for the first couple of days, it was really hard. It was very hard not to turn it back on. And I was quite shocked at myself, actually. Then after about 3 or 4 days, I realized something. All those books I've been reading with the TV on in my peripheral vision, I was losing a lot from them. When I started reading without having that noise and those images in the corner of the room, funny thing, I started to remember a lot more of what I'd actually read. Now, I'm not one of those people who says you shouldn't watch TV at all. That would be ridiculous. You can't bring up children. I mean, I've known a person or two who's tried, but you can't bring up children in that world today, too, completely removed from modern media. But there is really a difference between watching 1 or even 2 hours and having it on all day. And it's one of the most interesting things is between 1980 and 2000, the amount of time the average person and household spends on TV hasn't changed. TV is on in the average household between 7 and 8 hours a day, depending on which study you look at. But what has changed is the proportion of Americans who say they watch whatever's on, as opposed to a specific program, has doubled from about 20% in 1980 to 40%. And that is pretty significant, because that's just a 20-year period. I can't compare our culture today to some golden age that may or may not have existed 200 years ago or 100 years ago, but 1980 I remember, at least I think I do, and that's pretty significant that twice as many people are willing to just have it on whatever is on. I think it is, anyway. Yes, sir.
You talked about the left also contributing to the decline of our love of education. Can you elaborate?
Yeah. I think that the left, the extreme left, has contributed to the decline of education in this way. In the 60s, at the end of the 60s, there was this entirely justified, and I was covering education for the Washington Post at that time, and I had just been a college student. I was really young. And so I remember it both as a student and as a reporter covering it. And there was a demand for African American history, for women's history, for later on for gay history, and for all of the whole things we think of as multicultural studies. A very justified demand. But what happened in the early 1970s, after the campus upheavals of the 60s, not on every campus, but on most of them, is there was a settlement between the left and the right on college faculties. And the settlement was this, that yes, we'll have African American history, yes, we'll have women's history, yes, we'll have Latino history, yes, we'll have everything that's now known as multicultural studies, but we'll put it off in separate departments. You won't actually be required to study any of this stuff if you want something else, but those who want to will. And this made the left happy, because the creation of a multicultural studies ghetto created a lot of jobs. It instantly created a lot of new jobs. And it made the right happy, because those who did not want to work in what I call a multicultural studies ghetto were able to go on teaching basically as they always have, as if only dead white men were worthy of study. And this was a settlement which really brought peace in our time on college campuses. And it's not true on every campus. There are universities, for instance, where lots of white students do take African American studies courses. But it is rare. Usually these classes are ghettoized. I'll give you a great example. A few years ago, I had just read, I was lecturing in San Diego, and I had just read this great book by the great African-American historian John Hope Franklin. And it's really a unique book because he was called Mirror to America. He was born in 1915, and it was almost a history of race relations in the 20th century, but written by a professional historian who also experienced it from the point of view of a young people were colored when he was born, as he describes it. It's a kind of book which belongs in every American history class, because it's American history. It's not just African-American history. And I mentioned this at my lecture, and a girl came up to me, and she was white, and she said, "Oh, I love that book. I read it in my African-American studies class." And I said, "Are there a lot of white people in your African-American studies class?" And she said, "No, I'm the only one." And she said, "There are a few Vietnamese, but everybody else is black." This is what's wrong. This is what's wrong with having everything shunted off into that ghetto, because majority students are being deprived of knowledge they should have to have an understanding of American history. And minority students who take only those courses are being deprived too, because all they're being fitted for is careers in the multicultural studies ghetto. Everybody, it is possible to graduate from college today. I graduated from Michigan State University in 1965, which is neither the best nor the worst university in this country then and now. Middling, I'd say. I'd heard of them, but I was never required to read W.E.B. Du Bois in an economics course or Langston Hughes in a poetry course. And it is entirely possible today for somebody to graduate from just such a university as ignorant of all of these things as I was at the time. And that's not right. And that is where I say that both the left and the right have contributed to it. Also, there's another way that I think that the culture wars of the left and the right have contributed to it, which may be even more important, which is at the elementary and secondary school level. The idea that schools could teach how to think, but not facts and memorization, that's a left idea, and of course it's a good idea. The idea that schools should teach only facts and dates and chronology is kind of a right idea. But the truth is it's wrong to think of facts and dates and timelines in opposition to critical thinking. They go together. You can't think critically about, let's say, race in America again, if you don't know that the Revolutionary War was a long time before the Civil War, or that this is another thing, the National Constitution Center, fewer than half of Americans under 30 know that the Constitution originally permitted slavery and what the formula for it was. You can't discuss the history of race intelligently if you don't know what led to what and in what order. So in that respect, setting up an opposition between facts and critical thinking as though they had nothing to do with each other was a very fundamental mistake, which I think both, again, the left and the right participated on.
You mentioned the 60s. I remember thinking the whole time I was yelling power to the people. That was a voice in my head saying, "No." But I'm thinking, and I don't know what the question is, it seems to me that for a large amount of time in history, there's been a marriage between power and religion, that they both supported each other. As long as I got the power over people's souls, I'll let you have the power over their well-being. Mm-hmm. And when I couple that with my base emotions of lazy and materialistic, if I can promote those things, as we might do in the media, particularly when I have various, licensing relaxations and various corporate changes in how media is distributed to us, maybe there really is an invisible hand that's coming after us.
Certainly there are marketers coming after us all the time. But I don't think their hand is all that invisible, to tell you the truth. And in fact, the marketing of videos for infants and TV for infants is a great example of it. And how they do it is they try to market it basically to very, very sort of anxious upper middle class parents. And what they try to market it as is not what they really mean. It's, this is a great opportunity for you, you know, to have a few drinks with your wife or your husband and not have to have a little kid bothering you, which, as I said, is fine for an hour. But they market it to them as this is making your baby smarter. When in fact, all of the studies, and I said the best studies on this have been done here in Seattle at the University of Washington, all of the studies show that that's not the case, that the babies get smarter. And it's logical. I'm not surprised at that business about vocabulary and attention spans, because you get more vocabulary. How do babies learn to speak? They learn to speak from hearing people talking to them. And it makes sense to me that children who've been exposed to video from day one would have shortened attention spans, because that's what video is designed to do. It's designed to shorten our attention spans, and it does a good job of it. So I don't know about the invisible hand, but
I'm
sure.
Thinking more in the vein of a Al Franken joke, where you have two guys on the news program, and one says the earth is flat, the other says the earth is round. The reporter comes on and says opinions are divided.
Right. I talk about that in my book. And that, by the way, that's the way the media cover most scientific stories. What this is, of all kinds, this is a perversion of the traditional notion of journalistic objectivity, which says that the truth is always equidistant from two points, when in fact there are many issues on which one side is entirely right and the other is entirely wrong.
Looking outside of the borders of the U.S., do you see trends of this in the world, or do you see this as a sort of isolated American or U.S. phenomenon?
Oh, no, it's not isolated in the United States at all. It's gone farther in the United States, as so many things have, than it has in other countries. As I said earlier, I think one of the things that makes us, there are two things that make us more susceptible. One is just we're in love with technology. And when I was talking about technological solutions to non-technological problems, well, Bill Gates, 2 years ago, when he announced his next incarnation of Windows, I forget what the name of it is now, it's in my book. Somebody here must. Yes. It added parental controls, so that parents would know how much time their kids were spending and exactly what they were looking at. It added a new layer of parental controls beyond what you, and he said this was going to, because I'm concerned about my old children, this is going to be able us to know what our children are doing on the net every minute of every day. Well, now, of all people, Bill Gates knows better than that. He knows that whatever parental controls there are on a computer, that any smart 10-year-old is going to take 2 months, maybe 3 months, to figure out a way around them. But so I think what that was not just Bill Gates, the businessman, speaking. I think it was Bill Gates, the sort of hopeful American parent, thinking that somehow there's a technological solution to keep kids away from the fruit tree in the Garden of Eden, which he himself has set before them. If there is any way, for instance, to keep kids from spending 4 hours a day at video games, it's only not by some automatic control on a computer, but by parents talking to them and setting an example for them and being there. It's the idea that they're, so we've always, as Americans, had a big faith in technical solutions. But I think that there's also another element, which is particularly in Europe and Asia, highly educated people have always been respected. You know, this idea that the elites are bad doesn't exist in those countries. And I think that this penchant for technical solutions to non-technological problems, it also dovetails very nicely with our suspicion of too much education. I actually don't believe that somebody who speaks like George Bush speaks could be elected president of any country in Europe, because I think that the fact that he speaks so poorly would disqualify him in the eyes of most Europeans. So I think that we have in America, it dovetails with our suspicion of too much education, sort of the idea of the beer, the bowling test for office. One more, I'm sorry. Yes.
Just applying all that you've shared with us today and all that all of us here in this room see around us and recognize every day, I think we all will agree that this democracy game that we've enjoyed for 200 years depends on an informed electorate. Mm. And that informed electorate applies critical thinking to make the whole thing work. And it's obvious through the things that you pointed out tonight and what we see every evening on the news that we lack that critical thinking ability. And that's led us to basically a non-functioning government. We're in a war that we can't end. We are violating the Constitution and we let it slide. And physically, fiscally, we all know what's happening. So my question to you, and by the way, I'm in chapter 3 of your book, I'm trying to get to the end, see what you have to say about this. We are in a race.
What I have to say is I wish you weren't about to ask me the question that you're about to ask. Go ahead. Give me your best shot.
All right. But where do we have a chance to preserve democracy as we know it at the level of critical thinking in our society? And if you are optimistic, please share with us your thoughts about how we can hold on, because I'm looking
forward. All right. I have to tell you, frankly, I'm not optimistic. But I also don't feel hopeless. I think that I'm actually surprised. Frankly, I expected my book to be its usual thing, to get a lot of praise and sell no copies at all. It's been quite the opposite, actually. It's gotten a lot of brickbats from both the right and the left, but it's on huge numbers of bestseller lists. It's the first book I've ever had that sold this book has sold more copies in 2 months than Freethinkers did in 4 years. So what that suggests to me is that there is more concern out there, which hasn't been articulated by anyone, then I realized there was. I've gotten thousands of emails from young parents, people under the age of 35, who are parents of young children, who were really considering the problem of video and worried about it themselves. Now, I don't know, there's a new organization in Washington called Common Core. There was a big report on it today, and it includes for the first time some moderate left-center and right-center intellectuals about what to do about schools. But then on the other hand, you look, it's not just a matter of ignorance, and this is why it's also a matter of values. Look, Arnold Schwarzenegger has just proposed in California cutting $4.8 billion from the elementary and secondary school budget. Pink slips have been issued to 20,000 teachers. Now, this is a shell game in California. There maybe will only be 10,000 teachers laid off, but there was an article in last week's Los Angeles Times. School districts all over the state are turning to private foundations and private assessments of parents to keep some of their teachers that the state budget will cut out. Well, what does that mean? It means more inequities between the richer and the poorer neighborhoods. It's no way to run a country or the state of California. And it means that the governor of this state thinks that people don't care enough about education that he can just do this. And I saw there was a letter to the Los Angeles Times that I saw, and it said, you know, why are you writing this ridiculous article? If the money isn't there, it just isn't there. So there's Americans are always talking but not putting their money where their mouth is, and I think that's part of the thing too. I have to sit down now. I've been up since 4 a.m. this morning, and I'm kind of my time, New York time, and I'm kind of losing my voice. So you've been a great audience. Thank you.